Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the show, Robert Knott will be speaking with us, speaking of the arts. Robert Knott, you're here right now. How is that?
Well, I decided to show up and bring Craig Smith with me.
Craig Smith is here. He's an arts writer for the Pasatiempo, as you are, as well as being the associate editor. And we're here to do that which we do every year or two, which is talk about criticism, the function of criticism and the vicissitudes of critical writing. What is the function of criticism? I mean, the arts exist whether there's criticism or not. What role does criticism play?
I think criticism should exist to make people uncomfortable or make them feel they've done a good job. Those are the two extremes.
So it's directed not so much toward the audience, but toward the artists?
It's directed toward the audience and the artist. If the artist doesn't realize how good or how lacking their work is, they're not going to be serving their audience well. So I think the critic has the responsibility to say, this was good, this could be better, your idea is good, but it needs this kind of change, or possibly this should be sent to the bottom of the ocean with 800 pounds of metal attached to it. Because if the artist does a good job, and then they begin to educate their audience and, as well as please them.
So does the artist provide constructive criticism?
The artist or the critic?
Pardon me, the critic.
It has to be constructive. It's sometimes fun to go ahead and take the flick knife, but many people don't do that now. We try not to, I don't think. There have been some famous writers who talked about, I remember one who talked about one singer whose name should be nameless, who said she looked like a million bucks and sounded like shredded wheat. You know, that's to me, going it a bit.
What's the famous quote about the cash should be taken out at sunrise and shot?
Yes, the cash should be gently but firmly shot at sunrise.
Well, here's the thing. I was at the Santa Fe Concert Association programs on Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Wonderful performances. I saw you there, Craig Smith, mm-hmm. at least on Christmas Eve. And I was reading the program notes. So the New Year's Eve program included Rachmaninoff. And in 1897, the composer and critic Cesar Cui, whom we probably haven't heard of compared to Rachmaninoff, wrote... if there were a conservatory in hell, and if one of its talented students were instructed to write a program symphony on the seven plagues of Egypt, and if he were to compose a symphony like Mr. Rachmaninoff's, then he would have fulfilled his task brilliantly and would bring delight to the inhabitants of hell.
Yes.
Now, he was wrong.
He was wrong in our judgment. In the judgment of the day and in his own judgment, he was absolutely correct. And I would certainly not, if I had him here before me, I wouldn't say he was wrong. I might say he could have chosen a different simile or metaphor or case. But I will say this, nothing reads worse than old criticism. Criticism has to be new, it has to be fresh. We can learn by reading the past and seeing where people went wrong in terms of taste or maybe even fact, but we have to be constantly moving ahead on the things we see and experience now.
Rachmaninoff read that review and didn't write for 3 years. And I think that there's a lot of responses that I had to reading that, and one of them was, you can, if you're not careful, squelch the talent and... especially for a young artist, their ambition by writing a really very harsh review.
So what? It's interesting because it opens up a whole bunch of questions for me, and I think critics should always be asking questions as well, even if they don't have the answers. one thing is artists they've got to find a way somehow to realize and accept and hopefully understand that the critic's job is part of the whole process. Right now, as it's set up in society, that may change. It could change at the New Mexican if they don't want critics. It could change if readers wrote in and said, it's not just that they don't want Robert Knott and Craig Smith, they don't want criticism. You never know. But it's part of the process, and it's tough to maintain an objective and sometimes hard shell when you know that these words can, in fact, sting, hurt, bring somebody down. You're pretty self-assured on the radio, and we don't really talk about whether you get criticism, but it bothers you. If it does, I get it once in a while as a critic, and I have to take it in and think about it. it makes me rethink what I'm doing, but it's not going to make me feel so insecure that I'm going to stop what I'm doing. Having said that, you got to be open to saying, okay, is there something in that point of view that's accurate? It's interesting. I interviewed Argus McCallum today. He's on the cover of Pasta Tempo. He's been in theater for 40 years. Part of our discussion, which did not make it into print because of space, was about criticism. And to his credit, he actually said he went back and looked at some old reviews of stuff that had been written about him. He didn't say from me specifically. And he said, I realized, okay, there, that guy was right. There, this one had a good point. And sometimes you do have to step back. I've stepped back now and look at some things I've written 5, 6, 7 years later, and I can be very critical of them. Mm-hmm. And I understand now other people being critical. We're yes. critical of our own writing of years ago, you're right.
Critical of our own writing, for sure. But part of the thing you mentioned, Mary Charlotte, about squelching. If a critic can really squelch a person, an artist, that person is not much of an artist, in my opinion. You
well,
have to have...
Rachmaninoff.
But he was young when he wrote that symphony.
Yeah, he was young when he wrote that symphony.
He may have been going through a period when he was feeling less assured than usual. But if you're going to put it up there and be a professional and say, I have something to give the world that is major, that is important, that is going to make a difference in the life of the person who sees or hears me or experiences my work, then if you have any sense, you know that you can't do it all alone. Otherwise, you'll have an ego the size of Mount Rushmore, and your art will really never amount to anything but pretty hotel art, if you'll excuse me. In any genre, a good tough critic is the best friend anyone can have. But again, there's criticism that slash and burn, and there's criticism that is sort of like, let me give you a little slap with one hand and prop you up with the other.
I think there's another. I mean, the other side of this is if something is very harsh, an artist, even as you know, of a high caliber, can be set back by this, and maybe, you know, maybe in those 3 years he did a lot of other things that helped his work later, who knows. But I mean, the other side of it is that you often hear some artist or performer who gets a negative review saying, oh well, it's like what they said about Rachmaninoff, I'm clearly ahead of my time and they don't understand me. And that is often I've used as an excuse when something actually is atrocious and will not stand the test of time.
If they don't have if they don't have self-reflection, then criticism's not going to help
or hurt.
Likewise, a good point. And yeah, how many times do we go see a friend in a show, we're not criticizing it, you're not doing it, me or Craig, we're on our night off maybe, and we know it's not very good, but we have to go backstage and say something. And how often have we been in shows where someone said, oh, thanks, I'm glad I came, blah, blah, and they leave, and you kind of know that's the extent of the talk you're going to have because probably it didn't grab them.
Right.
But they feel uncomfortable saying to you, this wasn't good, and I don't think that should be said incidentally at the backstage door the night of the show either, but and a critic has to say, this has problems for me. And it does become about the critic and their viewpoint. There's mm-hmm. no point in saying it's not. That's ridiculous. But that viewpoint is based on having paid attention. And something that local and regional critics don't get enough credit for is they pay attention. We're not in New York, but the New York Times reviewers, they're having a hard time covering the entire New York. We know Santa Fe. We know what we're covering. We've seen it. I've seen theater work in Theater Grotesco at their best. And it's unfortunate because then I've also seen them at the worst. Now, I'm the guy paying attention that's going to have to put my words out there. I have to stand by my words and be comfortable with those words. I have a reputation, and it's too bad for them when that's the case, but I also honor them when they do well. And I'm picking two theater companies that have a history here, and they have very strong directors, David Olson with Theater Work and John Fox with Grotesco, who really stand out because of that. I've seen them at their best. I've seen them at their worst, and I'm the guy that has to say that.
Now, you had a little back and forth over the summer with Theater Grotesco.
Yeah, it was in print, and that's unusual, but, you know, my review ran. It speaks for itself. I don't have to say much more about it. John Flax responded with a letter. He's not here to speak for himself, so there's no point in commenting on that, but he did. He had a right to do that, and he spoke back. He was unhappy with it, unhappy with my review, and that's part of a dialogue.
But you know what's interesting? You gave the piece what he perceived as a negative review. A close friend of mine went to the performance based on reading your review.
That's an interesting thing. Craig and I talk about it all the time. We don't really know. And I don't think the theater company or the opera companies know. And if they do know, I'm not sure if they would share with us, do our reviews have an impact on them? I don't believe it. My heart tells me this. If you're on the fence, a good review is not going to send you to a show you don't want to see. a bad review is not going to keep you from going to see his show. You definitely want to see us. Only if you're on the fence, maybe you say, well, the guy in the newspaper gave it a negative. I guess I'll skip it.
That's true, but one of the things that we do as critics and writers, too, is we preview. And I think it's important to say that most critics do a lot of other writing as well as criticism. And we know cases where a cover story or a big story in PASA has turned a ticket slowdown into a fast rush.
Right.
With previews and profile pieces and cover stories, absolutely. We do know that. We do hear about that. But with reviews, it's different. I honestly don't know what impact. I'm glad that that's the case, and I don't think... It's very rare that I've said in a theater piece, go see this. I have done it, and a couple occasions I've said, I'm suggesting you don't go. But for the most part, I put out the ideas, and people can read from themselves. We talked a little bit about this the last time we were on the show. Again, I think it's the reader's responsibility to get to know the critic. They can choose not to respect or like his or her opinion, but they've got to get to know the critic by going to the shows, reading the reviews, and saying, this guy's just not on the same page as me. Now I'm doing my job. They can figure out how to respond based on what I've written, even if they don't agree.
We're talking to Robert Knott and Craig Smith about arts criticism. What qualifies a person to be an arts critic? How did each of you get into this? Do you have to have been an artist if you're or a musician or a student of art history or a student of music?
Robert's pointing at me, so I'll take the bull by the bit, as it were. I think it's very helpful to have done something active in the arts. I know there are programs today that I will say purport to teach criticism, and I imagine they can succeed. I think it always helps to have done something or been involved in some way yourself. Then the intellectual knowledge you get is layered over the body knowledge you have of what it feels like to open your mouth and sing, or what it feels like to pick a piece of paper up and draw on it, or what it feels like to go on stage under lights or dance, something like that. It doesn't have to be in the same area. In other words, you don't have to be an expert in all the art areas to be an arts critic. But I do think some practical experience is invaluable.
You have to love the art form. You have to want that art form to succeed and not be a cheerleader who, when that art form is not succeeding, keeps going rah, rah, rah. You cannot do that. You have to understand and know it. I think he's right. If you have a background in it, I studied theater at the University of Arizona and later at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. I worked as an actor, writer in New York for several years, came here and bounced around with a lot of the groups here. That is definitely to my advantage. You have a similar background, Craig. That said, I do believe there are exceptions, and Joe Ditzler, who used to be with The Journal, he's since gone up to Alaska, is a good example. He started writing theater criticism at 17, never took a class or stepped on stage, and I knew him. 20 years later, he turned into a good theater critic. You can do it that way. Obviously, book critics have never written a book, film critics. Mm-hmm. It is doable. I think
a lot of book critics, I mean, if you look at the New York Review of Books, the New York Times Book Review, they've all written books.
Right, but most film critics have not written a film. There's some exceptions.
Have made a film, yeah.
I think it's better to have had the experience, to have studied, even if you didn't pursue it as a career, to have studied and pursued it as a career. It gives you weight. It often gives you weight, even though they don't want to acknowledge it, with the artist you're talking about, although you will occasionally hear comments about, well, his career didn't go anywhere, so that's why he's writing this. And it's just segued. I segued into criticism here in Santa Fe, as did you, coming off of working in the theater scene here back in the early 90s. It happened, and I still embrace and like it. But I do think there are a few exceptions where someone can develop over time into a good theater critic without having had that background, or whatever critic.
There is that question that you alluded to just now of, are critics sometimes frustrated artists? And if they are, does that mitigate their ability to give good criticism? In other words, are they competitive with the artists whom they wish they could have been?
I wouldn't think so. I came to Santa Fe after a summer season with the Santa Fe Desert Crown in 1983 because I fell in love with Santa Fe. And when I moved here, I found that there were no singing jobs. There was no real chance for me to pursue the doctorate I was working on when I moved here. But I had compensation in the work I was doing in the nonprofit field, and I love Santa Fe so much I didn't want to leave. In effect, I have then transformed myself through luck and hard work into being an arts critic and writer. I backed into the job of the New Mexican, and I feel very lucky I never went to journalism school.
Right.
In that sense. Yes, there are great critics in New York. There are great critics everywhere. They're well known. But, the more and more people I know in the arts, the more I realize that people read the story and not the byline. Only if they know you
That's
as
true.
A critic do they care who you are.
Yeah, I've often read an article and not remembered who wrote it, which is
or Robert and I, people will stop me on the street and say, I love that piece you wrote about so-and-so. And of course, Robert wrote it. And I say, why, thank you so much. And then I tell Robert.
Also, I'll go to parties and someone will say, there was a piece in PASA yesterday and it was all about blah, blah, blah. And it was my story. And they honestly don't know I wrote it. The guy in the paper, it's always the guy in the paper. And this is true criticism. Pay attention. It's not enough to say the newspaper said I shouldn't go or that lady said I shouldn't go. Who was that lady? Find out her background as a critic, et cetera, et cetera. That's all.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another question that comes up, which is the question of personal taste. It may be that there's a whole entire genre that you, a music critic, love and another one that you're pretty lukewarm about. But you have to be a critic. You have to be, mm-hmm. I mean, is there such a thing as objectivity? How do you handle it?
Others may disagree with me. I can hear them chortling over the wire now, but I feel I'm objective. When I go to something, I put my enjoyment completely aside. I put my dislike completely aside. I've seen people weeping or laughing in a show, and I sit there. My job is to observe. My job is to tabulate and then express what I have experienced. So I can put that aside, no problem. I have sometimes reviewed films for PASA Tiempo, and I do not consider myself an educated film critic, but the type of film I'm asked to cover, a music, an art, a special film, one made from a great classic, that I feel I can comment
right.
on.
And
well, you had to deal with this summer when Craig was called out of town. You, Robert Knott, ended up being an opera reviewer.
For The Marriage of Figaro, and I addressed it as a piece of theater. It was the only thing I could do. I was out of my element. That's not an easy thing to say, but I was out of my element. Nonetheless, the paper asked me to do it. It needed to be done. I gave it a mostly positive review based on looking at it as a theater piece. I didn't have Craig to fall back on to say, okay, is this the right thing? I didn't try to pretend I didn't know that I knew what I was talking about. And occasionally I did a dance review about 4 years ago, also out of my element, but I tried my best to look at it as theater and also make a decision. Do I want to try to study and learn this? No, not really. So probably that's not the way for me to go in the future. If the paper asked me to do it again, I would do it, but I had that honesty. But it really proves to me how valuable Craig is to the paper. He knows his classical music, and it's hard when people read that. And you know what? This is egotistical. I've been covering the theater beat now for just shy of 10 years. I know the theater beat here. And that can be upsetting if you say, I'm tired of seeing director Bill Smith, I'm making the name up to the best man knows there's not a director Bill Smith there, not getting better. And actor Bill Henry, and I hope there's no such actor in town, is not getting better either. And you see those things. And you know, I'm getting to where it's getting harder and harder for me to avoid that or ignore that.
And in this time of economic slowdowns with groups closing down or trying to merge or trying to find what's going on, I think quality art is more important than ever. I think people will respond to it. I think they will still support it. I think they will still go to it. But this is the time when the real energy from the artists will pay off and not just getting by. That to me is the biggest weakness and sin in art, is getting by because you can.
I don't like routine theater. I would rather see dreadful theater that tried something and totally failed, was unintentionally funny and wasn't supposed to be, or was just so horrid that you actually remember a lot about it, rather than middle-of-the-road theater. And there's a lot of middle-of-the-road theater there. It's not dreadful at all. It's just okay, and that's not good enough.
We're talking to Craig Smith and Robert Knott about criticism. I was rereading some of your reviews, and there was a review that you wrote, Craig, of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, and you were talking, and you really liked it. It was a very positive review, and you said that they had a list of good qualities which we have come to expect and, in fact, demand of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. I thought, well, that's a very interesting thing, the audience demanding something of art. There's a transaction. There's a need, and it does bring up the sort of question that you could take 2,000 years to answer, but what is the function of art that human beings actually not just enjoy but need?
To me, it's a sense of ritual. It's a sense of community. It's a shared sense of exploration. It's something that then revives you. I think it actually has to do technically with endorphin release, although I've never studied that, and I don't know if there are studies that have looked at how people react or feel after seeing a great piece of art or seeing something. We heard about the Mozart effect, which is now apparently debunked.
That's been debunked, yes.
And yet I know that attitude and how you feel makes a huge difference in how your body works and how you function with others. I think art is a great cathartic, recreative experience.
You know, it's
like
funny.
The Greeks felt it was. You know, with the catharsis, the weeping,
right.
The horror.
I mean, there's a lot of ways to get endorphin release. You could go to the gym. But it seems to me, and I think this is one of the really positive functions of criticism, especially when I occasionally do read the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker, is that some of those critics, and maybe it's not so much what happens in local journalism, although it happens here too, can place pieces in a much larger cultural context. And to understand where we are now, because I think oftentimes artists, without consciously being able to explicate it, represent where we are historically and nationally and politically and emotionally as a group.
I think that's important. I wanted to say something about that the site Santa Fe this last summer, the seven, lucky number seven.
Right.
I looked at that, and I'm not going to try to comment on what Doug Fairfield, the art critic for the paper, said, but to me, most of it looked like the kind of experimental happenstance in the middle of the campus art that I was doing in college 25 years ago. It looked silly. And
yep.
I didn't have to review
it,
but
you're
that's
saying.
What I thought.
You know, it's a lot to ask of a critic, especially with a limited time. You have 2 minutes on the radio, 3 minutes on TV. We have 500 words to do everything that we're asked to do, and yet somehow we try our best to do it. And those verbs, which include reflecting, and we're going to be very imperfect reflections, because we are not those people. We have not gone through 6 weeks or 12 weeks of rehearsal, or with Grotesco, 6 months of rehearsal. I understand that. I have worked for four editors at PASA, and I want to go really quickly, even if all four of them are listening and disagree with what I'm about to say, about their attitude about theater reviewing. Denise Cussell felt you should be as positive as possible, get people in the theater, let them make up their own mind, put all the negative stuff at the end of the story so that if we have to cut it with an X-Acto knife, it won't be in there.
Those are the days of X-Acto knives.
Hollis Walker came in and said, hold these people accountable, go get them. They shouldn't be your friends, make them angry. Camille Flores came in and said to me, is this worth 2 hours of my time and $20? And Christina Melcher, the current editor, talked to me almost immediately about, place this in perspective. What is the company trying to do? Have they succeeded? What is their role in the community? What about the larger question? All four of those are absolutely accurate, and there's probably many
more.
Very
different and very different.
They're all true. You have to be positive and supportive. You have to call them. You do have to hold them accountable. They're saying, we're going to take you somewhere. We're going to take you down there to the land with really good acting. And then they don't do it, and they don't want to hear that. And I don't claim that our criticism is reaching for the same standards. I don't believe that. I've always believed they are artists, and I've brought this up to you, and we are craftsmen. There's a big difference there. It doesn't change the fact that we are watching them, and we can see these things, and they're very subjective.
Exactly. One of the things I do think, too, is Emily Post, in one of her etiquette books, talked about how the more formal a dinner is, the more it challenges criticism. And the more claims an artist makes by his or her work, the more they challenge criticism.
Examples.
Okay. I hold everyone to a certain standard. Say a local chamber group is doing something. I expect the people to know the notes. I expect them to know something about what the composer intended. I expect them to observe the signs he put in the music. And then I expect them to make something special out of it with their own input. That's what I would expect from the Santa Fe Opera. And yet the opera, with its megaplex of ability, there had better not be a light that's focused wrong. There had better not be a bouncing spotlight. When they did the Cinderella of Massenet, there was a moment when I could hear them nailing the carpet down backstage before Cinderella came on stage. That is not okay for a supposedly international opera company.
Right.
And that was a number of years ago. But those tiny things are where the warts really show.
And contrary to that, I do have room, as do you, without looking down our noses at anybody, without being condescending, to go to a community theater show and drop the standards and say, okay, Bill has never been in a show before. He's playing the second lead. You've got to cut that guy a little slack. You can change and lower your standards. You have to know the values of the
company. I don't think you lower them, but I think you alter them.
Okay, I'll take that verb.
Okay, you shift them.
But you do. You shift them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you wouldn't grade a sixth grader's paper the same with the same standards that you grade a 12th grader's paper. And there is a kind of analogous progress in a theater companies make as they get better. And some of them never get better, and some of them do, and they have an extreme amount of talent. But there's another thing in terms of multiple standards, which I had an interesting conversation with a man who was a professor of literature. And he said that in the 1980s, a lot of literary journals came up from, you know, the black community, the Hispanic community, the various ethnic communities, and had their own literary journals. And in the first years, they were just abominably bad. And then in the 90s, they were pretty good. And now in the 21st century, they're superb. And the same journals. And what's happened is in these communities, subcultures within the United States, if you want to call it that, there has just been huge improvement. Now, if you had said in 1985, this is garbage, what purpose would you have been serving? So they kept publishing and they got better. But it does make one wonder, at any point in time, what's appropriate to say? You know, just let them have at it.
Let's put you on the spot. What do you want from criticism?
I mean, it depends on the source. For the Pasatiempo, I really want to basically know whether I should go to the film or not. That's the first
thumbs
thing
up
that
or
I want to
down.
Know. Yeah. I mean, honestly.
It's happened. It's our society's become thumbs up and thumbs down. It's not just Siskel and Ebert, who are the two film critics that pretty much started that in the 70s. It's not just their fault, but quite often, and I'd be curious, Greg, if this happens with you, whether someone's read my review or not, usually if they haven't read it, they'll say, should I go? It's not that easy. Sometimes I can say, no, it's really not good. And sometimes I can say, I'm telling you, it's going to grab you. But usually that's criticism, a discussion, a dialogue, 500 words. Do people say to you, should I go or not?
They do, and sometimes, especially, I wrote a review of a very surreal film about music, and I said that I thought this was the greatest thing I'd seen in years. If I could buy a ticket for everyone I knew in Santa Fe, I would. And people flocked to it, and about half of them wanted to murder me, and half of them wanted to put a halo on me. So I have no answer for that. I'll say what I think, and, well, when I had to review Sweeney Todd with Johnny Depp, that was quite the experience, and I think I made it clear that you could waste 2 hours of your life in a much more positive way than this movie.
But you did take a lot of hits because it was critically acclaimed, and you know, you gave it one chili.
I think I gave it one chili.
And
I
went with you.
If I had given it a half, I would have.
And I might have given it two chilies. I might have said it's mild, but I wasn't impressed with the picture either because we saw it together at a funny preview.
I always think of what Alan King said when someone asked him something. He said, "Now, if I were a careful effete art critic, I would say so-and-so, but being Alan King from the Lower East Side, I say it stinks."
Well, and then there is the, I mean, if a famous person is making their debut in directing, or if it has certain famous actors in it, you're in a way predisposed to say something good about it. I noticed that during the Santa Fe Film Festival, there were a couple of films with very, very famous actors in them, which were mediocre, and other films where nobody had ever heard of any person who had anything to do with it, which were really much better. And that's tricky to talk about.
I suppose it is, but when someone big, to use that word, is doing something, all my critical hooks are out. I expect a lot from them.
There's certain actors in town, and if I mention them on the air, I hope they're going to forgive me, because I think a lot of them, I expect a lot from them. Rod Harrison's one of them, Mona Malek's another. I expect a lot from them, and at the same time, I will go in their corner. I have every right to go in their corner. Likewise, and I'm not going to mention names, there's a couple of actors in town that just aren't very good. I try to go in every time saying, maybe this kind of, and I'm very kind with them, but they're not getting better. You know, so I think you can bring that personal stuff regardless of their name quality. Also with talent quality, you know which sopranos are going to come back to the opera that you've continually seen at their best. That doesn't mean the next time around they miss the mark, you're not going to call them on it. I know you will.
But there is a difference. I know a critic who happens to dislike a certain singer's voice very much. He never gives the guy a good review at all. He doesn't like the voice.
There's the personal taste.
I think that's a flaw, though. You have to say, how did he do in the part?
Yeah, it is a flaw.
You see, I feel that's a
flaw.
At
best, and this isn't even very good, you have to say, I'm sorry, but I'll use a dead actor, film actor. Cary Grant's not my taste. But still, you have to find a way to go into this Cary Grant movie and look at it objectively. But at the very least, acknowledge. I recently saw David Olsen, a show he's doing coming up called Clean House. I saw the production in L.A. and I thought, this isn't a good play. And it was, you know, a slip of the tongue. I said to him, I don't think this is a very good work you're doing. And I would hardly ever say that to him. He's already chosen it, and he's chosen some really smart literary pieces over the years. Really, really good stuff. He always chooses interesting stuff. In retrospect, was I wrong? Probably not. I was honest with him. Should I go review it? I don't know. But if I do, I'd better say, I saw the original. Here's what I think the flaws were. But maybe I should step back and not. But, you know, this is rare. But at the very least, acknowledge you have a problem Let the reader know. Okay, so you don't like Mary Charlotte. Still got to be open to hearing what Mary Charlotte has to say and how does she do it.
I think there's another, for example, on this program, which is not about criticism or reviewing. It's about talking to others and really putting them on a platform to let their ideas be broadcast to, you know, to the people. There is, I have to make a lot of choices. And I would rather, I mean, I never will have anybody on whose work I don't like unless I agree to something in advance without having read the book or seen the film first, and that's happened from time to time, and I try not to do that anymore. But in a way, I'd just rather not have somebody on at all than have an awkward conversation with them or make it clear to the audience that I don't like them.
Right, you've expressed that to me, and I think one of the things Christine has done for Pasta Tempo is she has gotten us to where most of the previews now, she wants it because it's almost in itself an acknowledgement this is worth talking about. Which was not always the case in Pasta, no offense meant to anybody, including us as writers. Now we're much more picky. We want to know this is going to have some worth, which means that people should be really happy if they get a preview. They should be happy if they get a mixed media. And you do luck out a little without being too critical of you, because you don't have to be critical on the air. You can ask the smart questions of them, and you do. But you don't have to say, yeah, but I have a problem with this. What you do is you find a way to couch it in an interview. But you don't have to go on later and say, well, I previewed this book, but as it turns out, the book's not very good. I mean, you do get it.
I'll say that to somebody off the air if they ask me.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And also, I will have somebody on who's doing a local production or a book or whatever that I think is of, you know, medium quality if they're local, just because they're local.
Right.
Whereas if somebody writes to me from New York or California or whatever, doing something of that quality, and that's happened. They say, would you like to show my, you know, can you talk about my book or my whatever? And I see it, and I don't think it's very good, and they're not even from here, and there's no way I'm going to have them on my show.
I understand that. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is endangering criticism is, in a sense, what's also helped liberating media, which is the proliferation of things like blogs. I agree with some writers I've read that most blogs are simply exchanges or rants. There isn't a lot of consideration going on. And there's a lot of one-upmanship that goes on in blogs. People will watch a YouTube video of a famous soprano and make a crack about her dress, and someone else will call them a toad and a monster. And after a while, there's no time for that because you're not getting anywhere.
And there's so much commenting back and forth. Exactly.
Everybody's a critic. Everybody has always been a critic, but now everyone's a critic on the web. And again, at the very least, look into who they are, where they come from. Do they have any weight whatsoever? You can still disagree. You can disagree or disrespect my writing as a critic, but at least pay the initial attention to say, okay, I've seen where this guy's coming from. And a lot of these web guys, I don't know what you could find out. I'm in total agreement with you. Having said that, they do give you the thumbs up or thumbs down. This stinks. Don't go. You're going to listen to some guy you don't know on the other end of the internet, but if you're looking for that, and you get eight, this stinks, and two, go see it, is that what criticism has come down to?
Well, thoughtfulness, I mean, you know, you asked a moment ago, what am I looking for in criticism? And for the local thing, there is this question of, should I get out of the house and pay money tonight, or, you know, would I be better off staying home on the couch with the dogs? But there is something that I'm not looking for is florid prose. The more transparent the prose is, the better. So that, I mean, I can see what, when people say, oh, I don't even know who wrote it. In a way, you're doing your job because you're really speaking about the piece and it's not your own beautiful writing style. That's probably better left for other media. But I think also in, again, the sort of New York Review of Books or The Nation or The New Yorker style of criticism, being able to look at the big picture through the eyes of somebody who has seen way more art and heard way more music and thought about it more deeply than I ever have or ever will is really a privilege.
A lot of that is a space issue, because even though Pasta's a weekly, we don't have a lot of room.
That's right.
No, we get 500 words to make our case. But, you know, if we want 800, we can get it. What are some of the other challenges you see?
Yeah, but some of these these magazines, you can go on for pages and pages.
For pages.
What are some of the other challenges you see facing criticism?
There's, of course, the fact that so many jobs are being lost in the news media, in the print media. I don't pay as much attention as I probably should to broadcast media criticism. I don't read magazines like People, because to me that's one entire thumbs up. And so I don't take any critical writing in there very seriously.
Is there critical writing in there? I thought it was just about the pregnancy of movie stars.
Well, probably. I think they do some book things or movie things every now and then.
I also don't read them. Entertainment Weekly, which we do subscribe to at the office, they make some stabs at criticism. And some of it's not bad, and some of it is.
And I read professional journals and things, both online and not.
Do you have any role models, Craig Smith and Robert Knott, who are critics who've inspired you?
Harold Clurman's criticism holds up really well from the 50s. He was a theater director, and he was one of that rare example of someone who was a practitioner who also wrote really thoughtful reviews. And I have a pretty good handle of American theater from, you know, the 20s on to today. I don't pretend to know a lot about 19th century theater, so. And I like reading his stuff, but it was interesting what you said earlier about sometimes Shaw's criticism doesn't hold up well. It's very difficult to read through.
No, but sometimes he certainly knew how to get the zinger in.
He did.
I really like Alex Ross, who writes for The New Yorker and has written often. Oh. There are some of the daily critics and big papers I don't pay much attention to, but I like Mark Sweat of the LA Times because he's always very clear.
He is, yeah.
He's very clear.
Anthony Lane is a great film critic for The New Yorker, in my view. Because they do everything we're talking about, and they're entertaining to read. And sometimes that entertainment is simply clear, concise language, not trying to be funny. It's zippy, and you want to read criticism, you want to listen to criticism, and it should be.
Yeah.
You have to be a master of your medium, and I think, actually, I really do, I think we're pretty good at it in writing.
I don't know, a few weeks ago I wrote something about Santa Fe Pro Musica and a concert they'd done, and on this concert was the aria known as Sheep May Safely Graze by Bach. And I said that these sheep were not grazing, they were not only ambling, they were, I think I said, striding or running for the gate, and that it's not so bad to have a brisk tempo, but this one was out of the question. See, I thought maybe it was too clever, but the editors let it stand. I think making a point that way, this piece is supposed to be allegro, it's not supposed to be so fast that you can't see it.
And I try to avoid being snide at all costs, but I know once in a while I can't help it. I mean, if the cast looks like they're really a bunch of amateurs and they look like they should be in a police lineup, and it's the eighth show I've seen at this particular company and not getting better, I might actually lose my temper and write that. And it's probably going to be checked by editors, are you sure you want to say this? It's really not the way I like to go, but occasionally that is fun criticism to read when we're reading it. Everybody loves it. People love celebrity critics.
One of my favorite comments by a friend with whom I went to a movie once a long time ago was, we left the movie and he said, keep my money, just give me my time back. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of ultimate, like, this was the biggest waste of time. And there are things like that that happen in Santa Fe, and some of them get standing ovations because everybody in the audience is really supportive. And that is, to me, that's a problem. Nobody's willing to say that was just a piece of unadulterated.
But nobody listens to us. I know what you mean about the whole standing ovation concept. I firmly believe it's come about because over the years, the race of concert-going people has lost a layer of support in their rear, and therefore have to stand up faster because they're in pain, and therefore they stand up and applaud. I know. I've heard some. Now, there have been things that made me stand up. Not long ago, a Santa Fe New Music presented a pianist named Stephen Drury, who played a very powerful piece by Charles Ives. I stood up. It was worth it. It was well worth it. And there you have it.
There we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Craig Smith and Robert Knott are arts writers for the Pasatiempo, and we were doing our annual or perhaps biannual segment on...
I think it's our third time. It might be our third time over 4 years, but I'm pretty sure that...
We've been at least twice, two or three times we've done this together. And we'll do it again, and we would be delighted to hear anybody's comments. You can write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Craig Smith, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And Robert Knott, you're going to stay with us and do a short Speaking of the Arts.
Yeah, I will do so using the Pasatiempo, of course.
We'll be right back. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like now to welcome back Robert Knott. Hey, Robert. Sorry. And we are speaking of the arts, and one of the things we're speaking of is the fact that we're going to give away two pairs of tickets to La Rondinée, which is at the opera live at the Met, which is at the Lensic tomorrow morning at 11. And if somebody can call 428-1382 and tell the wonderful Mary Lynn who wrote La Rondinée, then you will win a pair of tickets. What do you think about that, Robert?
That's pretty good. Just don't ask me to go criticize the thing.
I'm not going to. So what's happening this weekend?
Susan Abad is playing tomorrow night, 7:30, gig performance space, jazz vocalist. Really good piece about her and her personal life by Paul Weideman in today's Pasatiempo. You got to pay to get in. Check out gigsantafe.com. We don't mention prices unless it's free or by donation on KSFR. And Jill Batson, a freelancer, wrote a really nice piece. First off, two parts on writing workshops in the northern New Mexico region. It's not related to any event, but I just wanted to point it out. It's a nice piece. If you're interested in various literary workshops, etc., writers' conferences, pick it up and take a look at her story. Again, it's part one of two, part two running next week. And I'm also going to promote, without it being tied to the show, my Q&A with Argus McCallum, who's been doing theater for over 40 years in Santa Fe. Pretty interesting Q&A. He's the cover story today in Pasa Tiempo.
Now, Levi Ben Shmuel is doing a workshop on Kabbalah and the Dance of the Tree. And the Dance of the Tree is a Tai Chi-like set of movements. And that is happening, let's see, Sunday from 3:30 to 6 at Body. For more details, you can call Levi at, or Levi, that is, at 670-4312. 670-4312.
Remember that song, The Sweetheart Tree, that Natalie Wood sang?
No.
They say there's a tree in the forest, a tree that'll give you a find. Come along with me to the sweetheart tree. You don't remember that? So good. She sang it.
Never
in some
heard
movie.
It.
She was standing. She was by the river with a guitar. She had just taken a swim, so all she had on was a towel. You never saw more than that, but that's okay. There's some art openings tonight. Backstreet Bistro across the street. I like their sandwiches. Has Places paintings by Nicholas Gadbois, B-O-I-S.
Gadbois, yeah.
Yeah, Gadbois.
He's actually an acquaintance of mine and a wonderful artist.
Well, there you go.
I'm so glad you're reading this.
5:30 tonight, free at Backstreet Bistro over there in Camino de los Marques off of, sort of off of Cordova. You can find it.
I don't know if I should say this, but 18 years ago, went to a show of Nick Gadbois' work, and I actually did something which I never had done before or practically since, which is bought a painting. And I've been living with that thing for 18 years, and I still love it.
That's pretty good.
It is pretty good.
Santa Fe Arts Commission Community Gallery is having Generations, an exhibit celebrating the artistry, work, and traditions of New Mexican families. Reception 5 to 7 in our new Santa Fe Community Convention Center on Marcy Street. Free. Show runs through March 6th. Friends of Archaeology, they're going to have a little lecture series about Edgar Lee Hewitt. Now, do you know who he was?
You tell us.
Right. I was hoping you'd come up with some usual encyclopedic answer. The guy was a famous archaeologist. He did a lot of digging around these sites. He was up there in Bandelier and did other antics. If you want to find out about him, go see Edgar Lee Hewitt, Allies, Rivals, and Institutions by Michael Stevenson. He's with the Museum of New Mexico Board of Regents. This is tonight at 5:30 in the New Mexico Film Museum Theater at the old John Cocteau Cinema on Montezuma Avenue. Got to pay to get in. You want a phone number? Here it comes. 992-2715.
The Wheelwright Museum is seeking docents. They're doing orientation and training for new docents on January 13th, 20th, and 27th, and also in February. And volunteers, there's six sessions total, and volunteers must attend all six sessions to serve as docents. For any questions or to find out more, call Larry at 466-9404. 466-9404. The Wheelwright Museum is on Museum Hill.
If you like the local, I should say renowned, but living in Albuquerque artist, Judy Chicago, she's going to be talking and doing signings of Through the Flower, My Struggle as a Woman Artist. And I'm talking with Susan Fisher Sterling, who's director of the New Museum of Women in the Arts. This is going to be a luncheon gig on Sunday at the Inn of the Anasazi in Washington Avenue. You do have to pay to get in and eat. Here's the phone number, 986-9695. Did you see my Pasa Tiempo piece last week about doing cowgirl karaoke?
No.
Well, there's cowgirl karaoke. You go to the cowgirl on Monday nights, and you don't have to be a cowgirl. You don't even have to be a girl.
What if you're a cowboy? Do you have to be a cowboy
you can do
if you're
it.
A boy?
Yeah, I went, and I did a Dean Martin tune.
Of course you did.
I know, but everybody else was doing, like, these songs from the 80s. It was crazy. They were, like, doing the toughest songs in the world to sing from the 80s. You know, like, who would want to try Everybody Wants to Rule the World or what's that other one?
That other one.
Yeah,
yes, I hear Mary Lynn.
Yeah, it's probably better, Robert, than you singing from La Rondine. We have another pair of tickets, and someone called but hung up, and I want to let them know we have one more pair, and that La Rondinée is Saturday, January 10th at 6 p.m. at the Linzic.
Oh, it's at 6 in the evening?
Yes.
Oh, I got that wrong. I thought it was tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Okay, so 428-1382. If you can tell us who the composer is, then you get that second pair of tickets. Sacred Tibetan chanting, multiphonic singing with the monks of the Drepung Losaling Monastery. That is Saturday, January 10th at 7 in the evening. And the Drepung Losaling monks are featured on Golden Globe-nominated soundtrack of the motion picture 7 Years in Tibet, starring Brad Pitt, et cetera, et cetera. And they were here. They were on my show. They're amazing. So Body of Santa Fe is at 333 Cordova Road, almost across the street from the Santa Fe Baking Company. For more information, 505-986-0362 or bodyofsantafe.com.
Okay, I don't want to confuse things or spend too much time on this, but did she say that the broadcast is tomorrow night?
That's what she said. Is that not true?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not saying she's wrong and she can yell back at me, but...
I won't yell at you.
It's generally 11 a.m. and PASA has it at 11 a.m. Craig kind of knows his stuff, so call the Lensing to find out if there's any question, I guess.
Okay, but the information we got has that, and then somebody called and told me that as well, so okay. I'll check again.
Yeah, thanks. But call, if nothing else, call the Lensing 988-1234.
Okay.
Meanwhile, thank you. She's so sweet. She's got
great.
A nice voice.
She's got a beautiful voice.
Have I met her?
She's a very good engineer. I don't know if you've met her. How
yes,
do
we
I
met.
Know?
Uh-oh, okay. She's talking to me in that sultry voice again. I'm going to get in trouble. Santa Fe Community College is doing its open spring house Saturday, 10 to 2, at School of Arts and Design. Go on down, meet the instructors, meet the new dean of the arts department, see what the students are doing. If you're interested in going to school there, go down. If you just want to see art go down, they're on the south side of town. That rich boy you've been seeing. Remember that song, Poor Side of Town? That was good. Which is not the south side of town. Anyway, it's tomorrow. It's free. They're on Richards Avenue. Phone number 428-1436, 10 to 2, open house.
Lucy Lepard is giving a lecture on Monday, January 12th at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock. It's part of the Santa Fe Art Institute series, lecture series, and this is called A Lesser Evil, The Impact of Tourism on Our Places. Activist and writer Lucy Lepard has predicted and influenced art movements since the 1960s, has published, speaking of critics, 20 books of cultural criticism. And she will be speaking at the, as part of the series called Outsider Tourism, Migration, and Exile. There's many artists involved with that. That's all at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And the number over there is 424-5050, and it's at sfai.org.
Singer-songwriter Celia Farren is going to be performing at the Center for Spiritual Living on Camino de los Marques, 7:30 p.m. Saturday. Got to pay to get in, 983-5022. Paul Weideman wrote a little piece about her in the PASA today, page 12. And Craig wrote a little bit piece about the First Presbyterian Church's new C.B. Fisk organ. I guess there's going to be a little mini-concert about this with Linda Rainey directing. 5:30 p.m. tonight, music by Shearing and Dupree and Brahms and somebody named Claire Ambalt. It's at 208 Grand Avenue. Admission is by donation. We can say that. Phone number, 982-8544. Opening movies today, Gran Torino, Clint Eastwood, getting good word of mouth. I got to go see it this weekend. And a movie I liked very much at the screen called In Search of a Midnight Kiss, a very offbeat romantic comedy for younger people. It's a little profane and edgy, but it's pretty darn good. What time is it?
8:57. You've got 1 minute.
I've got 1 minute. I just want to wish everybody a happy and safe new year and hope that everybody stays hopeful and upbeat and helps us move forward in this crazy world we live in, including with criticism. It was nice of you to have us on.
It was my great pleasure. Hey, I've got one more announcement to read, and that is there's a call for auditions for children and adult supernumeraries for the 2007 Santa Fe Opera season. If you've ever dreamed of being in an opera, this is your chance. The auditions are held on January 21st, which is a Wednesday, from 10 to 4 at Stearin Hall in the Santa Fe Opera grounds. And the Elixir of Love needs adult men and women to portray townspeople, and men of 20 to 40 to portray soldiers and all sorts of things. The letter seeks men 20 to 40 resembling Asian nationals. And for Alceste, they need children 8 to 9 years old, teenagers 16, 17, and adults 60 to 80. For more information, you can call Christian at area code 212. This is New York. Area code 212-832 8757 or write to C-E-C-K-E-L-S, C. Eccles, at SantaFeOpera.org. And the deadline for applications is January 16th. And then, once again, the auditions are January 21st.
Elixir of Love sounds like a 1960s romantic song that would be like in an Ursula Andress movie.
You just couldn't get through a show without mentioning Ursula Andress.
Auditions, Arms in the Man, Santa Fe Playhouse, 11 o'clock tomorrow, 3 o'clock Sunday, 988-4262. That's Shaw, Catherine Donovan directing. Go on down if you want to audition.
Marilyn, did we give away the other set of tickets?
Yes, we did.
Yay.
And Robert, your editor, called and said that the Linzik did put on another performance. They're doing the performance of La Rondinée on Saturday at 11 and at 6 p.m.
Ah,
and they're both sold out. So
nice.
Our listeners who got the tickets have been very fortunate. And as we know, there's always people outside usually selling tickets that they don't want to use.
Nice for
and the answer was
my editor to check that. So
the
thanks.
Answer to the contest.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Puccini,
huh?
Yep.
That guy. He's always the answer.
Puccini.
Remember I asked you who the fourth
answer.
Stooge was, and you
we
said
thought
it was
love was the answer.
Love. Exciting and new.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte.
I know that.
KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Robert Knott is the associate editor of the Pasatiempo Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe New Mexican. He's here today speaking of the arts. We're delighted to have you, Robert.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here. And dilapidated.
We love you just the way you are.
Well, thank you. I'll come back next week.
And we are broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road. And I'm going to sign off now and have some bacon and eggs.
Oh, boy.
Have
Say
a wonderful weekend. You ready?
Yeah.
Hasta la vista. Ciao.
Oh, baby. That's it.